Your Science Magazine of the Air presents another story from The Human Adventure.
The Mutual Broadcasting System and the University of Chicago presents The Human Adventure.
Today, the unusual story of the development of time.
And as your host, Mr. Walter Yost, editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
The Human Adventure is the greatest of all adventures. It is a new kind of radio program designed to acquaint you with the methods of science, the drama of research, the findings of scholarship. Today, the story of minutes, seconds, hours. The story of time.
Listen to the sound of time. In 1 second, the Earth spins a fraction of a degree upon its axis, takes a step around the sun. In 1 second, the sweet taste of life may turn bitter in death. In 15 seconds, a bomber high above the Earth flies a mile through thin, still air, hostile with flak and enemy planes.
Pilot to Navigator. How's the time, Yo-Yo?
Right on schedule, Captain. And don't call me Yo-Yo.
When do the fighters join us, Yo-Yo?
10 minutes. Mustangs and Thunderbolts.
Did you get that, Bombardier?
Gotcha, Daddy. But are you sure you got the figures right? Don't want to keep the crowds waiting. Just off your bombs out, Jim. The rendezvous is for 2300. We'll be there.
Yeah, but how about them Thunderbolts and Mustangs? I don't want any interruptions when I'm aiming this baby.
Don't worry, pal. They'll be there. 2300 miles to go.
A war is fought with time. With the 5 seconds ticking off the navigator's chronograph. With the seconds of a bomb dropping 30,000 feet. With the seconds entered into equations in the bombardier's sight. A war is fought with rendezvous 2300 on the nose. A war is fought with time to expend materiel. And a war is fought with production, with the time to produce materiel.
Say, Charlie.
Yeah?
What do you say we knock off now? Just 5 minutes early for a cigarette.
Listen, pal. I got a son out there. A navigator. His job's to deliver the bombs on time. That's our job, too. You ain't taking 5 minutes off.
Time is production of materiel. Time is war and production. And time is information. 14 minutes and 30 seconds of radio news.
Supreme Headquarters announced this morning a successful run on the German capital last night at 11 o'clock Berlin time. The Allies report that casualties were light, with no planes lost. Meanwhile, in the Pacific...
Time is 14 minutes and 30 seconds of news. It is production. It is war. Time rides with death. But if time can kill, it can also heal.
Well, how's the shoulder, Yo-Yo? Any better?
Oh, I'm fine, Captain. But if you call me Yo-Yo once
more... Oh, calm, Yo-Yo. You're in no position to argue.
Just wait. Get this flak out of my shoulder.
Yeah, well, you just wait till they get you under either. I'm going to sit here and hold your hand, and all the time I'm going to be calling you Yo-Yo.
All right, boys, break it up. We've got some serious cases waiting.
How do you like that? He thinks I'm not important.
Well, now, really, Major, maybe you don't know that Yo-Yo...
Ready for anesthesia, nurse?
Ready, Doctor.
All right. Count as long as you can, Lieutenant. Breathe deeply.
One. Two. Three.
Four. Pulse 60 per minute. Respiration 20 per minute. Ready for surgery, Doctor.
Time is a bomber winging its way to rendezvous 2300. Time is the 5 minutes you stay on the job. Time is a successful bomb run on the German capital last night. Time is respiration 20 per minute. And the slow click of the anesthetist pump in an American hospital somewhere in Europe. And this human adventure, this is the story of time. Now your host on the human adventure, the editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Mr. Walter Yeust.
If you're interested in performing an experiment which requires no equipment, just try sometime to speak or think without once using any word or thought connected with time. Without a single always, never, now, then, once, sometimes, later, soon. Without a single reference to how a thing was or is or will be. After you have found it impossible, you can try a second experiment, which will prove that time, beside being completely simple, is also one of the most sophisticated notions we have. Just try to define time. Before you start, I'll tell you that's impossible, too. Today's human adventure is not the story of such semi-philosophical concepts. It accepts the rather vague time sense we all have, and is the story of man's more precise reckoning of time. It is the story not of modern university research, but of the lore of ancient scholars, an ancient chapter in those notebooks of science which recount the human adventure.
Man understands that which he can measure. And even primitive man made crude instruments to measure that which he did not understand. Time was one of those things that man did not understand. The calendar was before the clock. For in the history of man, the farmer and the shepherd came before the sailor, the city man, the worker at the machine. To the farmer and the shepherd, the day is important, for the day is the time of work. And to them, the year is important, for the year is the cycle of the seasons.
Our God, the sun, driven away by the cold wind, come back that we may harvest and live again in warmth.
Those voices, they are the voices of primitive man, a man so simple, of so little time upon the earth that he did not know, was not sure that the winter would be followed by spring or the spring by summer. Modern archaeologists have records that prove definitely ancient man's lack of knowledge. But they know, too, of the ancient age of greater knowledge about the seasons. They know of the calendar of the ancient Egyptian farmer.
Wake up, Nether. It is light.
I am awake, Jeannie.
Then get up. There's work to be done.
In a little while, I'm thinking.
Loafing, you mean. Loafing like a philosopher.
Thinking, I said.
What goes on in your head, husband, that you call it thinking?
Problems, Edie. The problems of a farmer when it comes to plowing, which we start tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Soil is still too wet for planting. Seeds will rot. You shall starve even more than last year.
You are a fool, Edie. It is the first month of the year, is it not?
Aye, it's the first month. Last year, remember, the star solstice did not rise with the sun till the second month. It had slipped your mind, perhaps, eh, philosopher?
Yes, wife, perhaps it did. But, Innie, this is a difficult matter. It requires a sharp mind.
Sharp mind. What good are your thoughts when the priests themselves don't know the beginning of the year?
Indeed, what good is a calendar to a farmer when the planting time, supposed to come in the first month, comes instead in the second? Said the late Professor James Breasted of the University of Chicago.
Some 4,000 years before Christ, the Egyptian priests, the scholars of their time, noted that the star Sothis, which we know as the dog star Sirius, rose with the sun shortly before the inundation of the Nile. They noted that these so-called heliacal risings of Sirius occurred 365 days apart. But they did not know what modern scholars know, that the year is slightly longer than 365 days.
The year is slightly longer than 365 days. Oh, a mere trifle. Barely a quarter of a day longer. One day in 4 years.
And so the calendar raced along, gaining a quarter of a day each year, one day every 4 years, 1 year in 1460 years. Until in 46 B.C., Julius Caesar, who was a smart politician as well as a soldier, conferred with the scholar astronomer Sosigenes, one of the most learned men of his time. And in this race between the seasons and the calendar, Julius Caesar called a halt.
This calendar is absurd. The people complain that the seasons fall on the calendar no longer as they did in their grandfather's day.
But is that important, Emperor?
Certainly. To the emperor of a restless people, any complaint is important. I want a calendar I can trust. One with some meaning.
I see. And now, Emperor, I think there's a simple remedy.
Well, the simpler the better for a simple, direct man like Julius Caesar.
I submit, a day cannot be cut into quarters.
Is that your simple remedy for the calendar?
Oh, sire, but since a day cannot be cut into quarters, I suggest simply that every 4th year, an extra day be added to the year.
Commendable, Sosigenes. A commendable suggestion.
Oh, it's nothing. But in this way, the calendar will once more be in harmony with the sun and with the seasons.
And so it was. And the Romans lived with success under a calendar that was fixed with 12 months, 365 days, 366 days every 4th year. They thought that calendar was absolutely accurate. And all went well, except that...
Except that the year is slightly shorter than 365 and one quarter days. Oh, a mere trifle. Only 11 minutes and 14 seconds. Barely a day in a century.
So for 1,600 years, the seasons crept slowly backward through the calendar. And then in the year 1582, when the seasons had shifted more than half a month, Pope Gregory XIII instituted the final change.
We direct that 10 days be stricken from this year, and that henceforth only those century years that are divisible by 400 shall be designated as leap years. Gregorius Episcopus Servus Servorum Dei.
Thus, after 5,818 years had passed since the first Egyptian calendar, we obtained the accurate calendar which we now...
Excuse me.
Yes?
There is still a small error.
Oh.
The Gregorian year is 26 seconds longer than the true solar year.
Does that bother you?
I'm not here to be bothered. I'm here to be exact.
Well, then, exactly what does 26 seconds a year mean?
26 seconds mean that we shall pick up a day in our calendar once in 3,323 years, 28 days, 16 hours, and 30 minutes. Approximately.
A year is the odyssey of a star across the sky. A day, the majestic march of the sun. But what is an hour? What is a minute? What is a second? Well, what are they?
A heartthrob.
The blink of an eye. A fleeting thought.
These poetical concepts meant nothing to practical men. But the problem of determining accurately the meaning of an hour was of immense importance to those who sailed the seven seas.
Ahoy! Ahoy! What ship are ye?
The Santa Maria! One day out of Palos, bound for Cadiz.
You're headed in the wrong direction!
Aye, we know! But the captain thinks otherwise.
88 men sailed with Columbus, some eager for adventure, some indifferent, some brought to the ships by force, and all of them, all were afraid. Europe was far behind them. They were alone and lost in space and time, alone and lost in a desolate ocean. Alone and lost, completely dependent on the navigating ability of one man, the master, Christopher Columbus.
Come, Pedro, I will show you. Over there. Do you see a star a trifle to one side of the moon?
A reddish one without a twinkle?
That is the one. The planet Mars.
Aye, Master Christopher, I see it.
A little while ago, at 8 by the ship's clock, it just touched the edge of the moon.
Would that I could have touched the dock at Palos at 8 o'clock.
Here, Pedro, read this. from the Sailor's Almanac compiled by the astronomers of Cadiz.
In Cadiz, on the 20th day of September, that's today, the moon and Mars are in conjunction at 11 o'clock. Well, what of it, Master Christopher?
Yes, what of it? A small fact. From somewhere in the Atlantic, Christopher Columbus saw the moon touch Mars 3 hours before the same thing was seen by the townspeople of Cadiz. A small fact, but a useful one. Astronomers had learned much since ancient Egypt.
The sun rises at 6 o'clock in Paris, but at 7 o'clock in Vienna.
Paris is 300 measured leagues west of Vienna.
Therefore, if an occurrence in the heavens is seen at one place an hour earlier than at another, the one place is 300 leagues west of the other.
So, Pedro, you see, if we see an astronomical occurrence 3 hours before it is seen in Cardiff, then we are 900 leagues west of Spain. Today, we pass the 58th meridian of longitude.
You are listening to The Story of Man's Development of Time, another chapter from the Notebooks of Science on the Human Adventure. Irrefutable logic Christopher Columbus had, but his logic was based on his observations. And what if his observations were wrong? What if his clock was wrong, if it was not 8 o'clock, but 7:30 or 8:30? Half an hour, more or less, and Christopher Columbus was 1,000 miles east or west of where he thought he was. Christopher Columbus pointed his tiny ships westward and found land only because his target was a continent. Yes, there were clocks, ships' clocks, and clocks on church steeples to call the monks to their devotions, gaudy clocks that sounded the hours melodiously, if inaccurately, from the towers of the town hall. Then, too, there were watches which were not watches.
And what time are you to meet this wench?
8 o'clock.
Better hurry, then. My right watch says it's 8:15 now.
That's absurd. My right watch says it's 7:45.
Well, perhaps you're right. My left watch says 7:30.
And mine, exactly 8 o'clock.
Well, let's write this down, then, and find out what time it is. Your right?
7:45.
My right, 8:15. Your left?
8 o'clock.
Mine, 7:30. Let's see, that's a total of 31 hours and 30 minutes. Divided by four.
Hurry,
and
hurry, perhaps I'm late.
Divided by four, and it's... Say, you'd better hurry. It's somewhere between 7:45 and 8 o'clock.
Oh, no need to worry. This wench I'm meeting, she doesn't have a watch at all.
Yes, in the old days when watches were called Nuremberg eggs because they came from Nuremberg and were the size of large goose eggs, in those days the village dandies carried two watches apiece and sometimes used to take the average time of all watches present in order to agree what time it was. And while clocks and watches were inaccurate, so was navigation inaccurate. Still, the ship set out from Spain, from France, from England, from Portugal, and it was as if the captains wore blindfolds. And they sailed, more and more of them, not to explore, but to trade. And some of them did not return.
Another ship lost. Let me explore in 4 months. We can't stun the lost captain.
Well, Sir John, what do you suggest? Do we build a bridge across the Atlantic? Do we simply smooth out the waves like a feather duster?
Please be serious, Captain. This is no longer a matter for joking.
Never was a matter for joking, Sir John. But what can we do? It's navigation that sinks these ships and drowns them in.
Navigation, you say? The science of navigation that you talk so much about?
Yes, and it is a science, Sir John. But a science is no better than its instrument. You give me a clock that'll not lose or gain a minute in a month, and I'll make your landlubber scullery boy the best navigator in the world.
But it was not Sir John who was to give the adamant captain an accurate clock. And the scullery boy was not to be the best navigator in the world. Instead, I discovered another landlubber, an Italian whose attention once happened to wander during a sermon.
And foremost among these is, for faith is that which moveth mountains. He that is without faith is like a wanderer in the desert.
Galileo! What are you staring at up there?
Nothing, Guido. Nothing at all.
Galileo, you're doing it again. What do you see up there?
Swinging.
Beetles. Put them out, Beetles. Put them out, I say.
Heart and brain, rhythmic beat, and lightning perception. From the heart and brain of Galileo, who observed to Shanskin the law of the pendulum.
When a pendulum, regardless of its length, swings through an arc, its time of swing is constant, whatever the length of the arc.
A pendulum moving through a small arc moves slowly, through a large arc quickly, so that the time of swinging is always the same, whatever the size of the arc. Galileo had a law. A law of such regularity that it could almost be used to time the sun and stars themselves. But Galileo's law was not immediately used for measuring time, not for 60 years, not until...
Have your words caught up with mine, son?
Yes, father. You may dictate now.
And therefore, if the pendulum be connected to clockwork in such manner as I have described, its regular swing will produce a clock which will measure time with an accuracy unparalleled in the history of man. That will be all, my son.
Yes, father. It is a great invention you have made. Something all the world will want to see, to behold. Oh, I'm sorry, father. I didn't know.
That's all right, my son. You have not offended me. But when this great clock is made, please see that it is equipped with chimes as well as a face, for the benefit of those of us who are blind.
Yes, the 77-year-old Galileo, formerly a scholar of the University of Pisa, was old, retired to a villa, and blind. But Galileo's invention of what modern watchmakers call an escapement, the regulating mechanisms of any clock or watch, soon became a successful pendulum clock, and later helped to become the basis of a ship's clock which lost or gained less than a second a week. The clock planted signposts on the oceans and the sea, and sailors followed them from the old world to the new. But while the eyes of the world were turned toward the sea, a change came over the continent itself. The factory appeared, and time became a commodity.
Well, Jonathan, it's been another good day. 200 machines going since dawn without a single breakdown. Very good day.
It's a hard day, Silas. A woman collapsed at her loom this afternoon.
Too much gin, probably. You know, I've been thinking, if we could buy or build 20 more looms and hire... What are you doing?
It's 8 o'clock. I'm going to blow the pretty whistle.
There's no hurry, Jonathan. Wait 10 minutes, even 5. What's 5 minutes to them?
The same as it is to you or me.
Nonsense. Give them 5 minutes and they'll just drink more gin. Give them more gin and they collapse at the looms.
I don't think gin's the only trouble in the world, Silas.
Come, Jonathan. Do you know how much cloth 200 looms can weave in 5 minutes? Don't be a fool, Jonathan.
It would never have occurred to me, Silas. Ah, what a head you have for business.
Yes, time was a commodity, for it was something that one could steal. It became precious, and while some men stole time, others tried to save it. Change the idea of a factory just to save time. This is what Eli Whitney did, and it was more important than the invention of the cotton gin. In 1798, Whitney wrote to the Secretary of the Treasury,
"It is wasteful to cut a gun stock, then fit a barrel to it, then adjust a trigger, a lock, and a hammer. Time will be gained, minutes, hours, whole days of time if the barrel, the trigger, the lock, all parts of the musket are made with such precision as to fit any gun. That is my plan, sir. Interchangeable parts.
Interchangeable parts. That was Whitney's idea. It was a fertile idea, an idea that bore abundant fruit. For Whitney's idea began a series of events which continue even today.
In the year 1800,
Whitney manufactures guns from interchangeable parts.
1895,
gasoline-driven horseless carriages appear.
1909,
Ford begins assembly line production of the Model T. The assembly line, an eternity of fluid time turned into tiny crystals and forced into moving channels. Today, a bare framework moving on an endless belt is fitted with wheels, doors, an engine, wings, and the completed bomber pulls away only a brief time after its journey began. And minutes behind it is another, and another, and still more. An assembly line is time. Time shackled to the wheels of production. Time shackled to the propeller of a giant of war.
Navigator. Pilot to navigator. How's your shoulder, yo-yo?
It's fine, fine. Try it for medical science. But don't call me yo-yo.
How's our time?
Right on schedule, Captain. Fighter escort in 10 minutes.
You get that, bombardier?
Okay. But are you sure you got the figures right, yo-yo? Yeah, I got the figures right. But these guys don't stop
calling me... Dust off your bomb sight, bombardier. The rendezvous is for 2300. We'll be there.
Yeah, but how about them Thunderbolts and Mustangs? Will they be there? Don't worry, pal. They'll be there, same as us. 2300 on the
moon. A war is fought with time. With the 5 seconds clicking off the navigator's watch and the seconds of a bomb dropping 30,000 feet. Up ahead, the fighter escort is coming in. And it will be so many minutes, so many seconds, till another successful mission is done. You can count those minutes and those seconds. You can feel the pulse of eternity. You can count time as it goes to war, as the future moves 1 second closer to the past. Science Magazine of the Air has brought you another story from The Human Adventure, a broadcast presented for American men and women in the armed forces in every overseas theater of operation. Armed Forces Radio Service.